You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hall of Fame surfer and jewel thief Jack Murph the Surf Murphy died in Florida. He was 83 years old. Murphy is best known for the daring heist of the American Museum of Natural History in New York in 1964. He and others went through a bathroom window to steal the famed Star of India Sapphire and other precious gems. The heist was the subject of a movie in 1975. Murphy and others were arrested 2 days later. He was then convicted of murder in 1969 and sentenced to life in prison, then received a second life sentence in 1970 for conspiracy and assault. He was paroled in 1986 when he settled in Crystal River, Florida, and established a nationwide prison ministry.
The story began with a theft of $400,000 worth of gems from a New York City museum, but the setting quickly shifted to Miami with the arrest of Murph the Surf Murphy and his friend Alan Kuhn, who at first was a bit camera shy. That changed later when the pair became the most photographed twosome in Miami for nearly a month. It seemed Kuhn and Murphy were in and out of court every other day. They came equipped with what every defendant should have, pretty girls and a big-time defense attorney, Harvey St. Jean. But for the lawman at least, all the comings and goings did not add up to much. The gems are still missing, some of the charges against the pair have been dropped, and now they say they may open a Miami Beach nightclub to cash in on the publicity, appropriately naming the club the Star of India.
Featuring Joe Sweeney from Thinking Sideways Podcast and filmmaker Vincent Caldoni, this is The Shocking Details.
Hey there. Welcome to another episode of The Shocking Details. I am Joe, joined as always by
Vincent Caldoni.
And this week, we're going to take a break from all the bloodthirsty, you know, violence and stuff and talk about something a little more light. We're going to talk about another heist, which, you know, we like to do from time to time. This one was, I think, the biggest jewel heist of all time. It certainly was up to that moment, anyway. We're talking about some important rocks here. We're talking about the theft of the Star of India.
Yeah, I've heard of that one.
Yeah, it's the Star of India is one of those. It's right up there with the Hope Diamond.
Exactly.
As being just an iconic rock, a gem, but it was not just the star that was stolen, but several other unique and priceless gems. And they were taken from the New York Museum of Natural History. And it was big news when it happened back in the mid 1960s. And It kind of got a little bit of a rematch in last year when one of the masterminds of the heist died. And that was in September 2020. And no, he did not die of COVID, by the way. He was 83 years old, natural causes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So these gems, they were living at the time in the J.P. Morgan Hall of Gems and Minerals on the fourth floor of the Natural History Museum.
In Manhattan.
So I got a question for you, Joe. What would all of these priceless gems be doing in a museum of natural history? It doesn't necessarily seem like the right place for them.
Yeah, I know, right? But, you know, it's more natural than, you know, diamonds and rubies and sapphires. No,
I guess it is.
As you may have sussed out from the name of the hall, J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan, rich guy. You people may have heard of him.
Yeah, I mean, isn't J.P. Morgan one of the wealthiest guys to have ever lived?
Yeah, he was. And so he was extremely wealthy at that time. Of course, I don't think he was a billionaire, but then again, inflation, et cetera.
I think if you adjusted it for today's money, I think he would be. I mean, he was a multimillionaire in a time when a loaf of bread cost 5 cents.
Yeah, exactly. And he was a major philanthropist. And so he actually bought all the gems that started this collection and donated them all to the museum.
Interesting.
And they are a popular exhibit. And by the way, there's another well-known rich guy and philanthropist who also played a smaller part in this caper, John D. MacArthur, who you may have heard that name.
I definitely have. If you listen to NPR, you're going to hear that name a lot.
Yeah, yeah. He founded the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Yeah, that's the very one.
Yep, I know it.
Yeah, he played a small role as well. And a few other names you may have heard also pop up in this story. Yeah.
So Morgan, JP, that's what we're going to call him. He made the acquaintance of George Frederick Kuntz back in the late 19th century. And Kuntz was Tiffany's, the Tiffany company.
Yeah.
He was their first gem expert. And he'd put together a fabulous collection of American gems that won a grand prize at the Paris Exposition. Morgan liked it so much, he bought the whole collection in 1890 and then donated it to the museum. Morgan then commissioned Kuntz to assemble a collection of excellent foreign rocks as well, which he also donated to the museum. The collection included 24 diamonds, 166 sapphires, a dozen rubies, 13 emeralds, 57 beryls, 92 tourmalines, 30 aquamarines, 70 topazes, and more than 2,400 pearls. And that's not even the end of it.
Oh, yes. And still more. And this is between the two collections that Morgan bought and gave to the museum.
Yeah.
And by the way, just to stress, these were not just ordinary diamonds and sapphires and rubies and stuff like you'd see in a jewelry store. I mean, these were unique and huge and, you know, and otherwise remarkably special gems.
Right. They're all the finest quality.
Oh, yeah. And some of them were just freaking big, which is always human beings. We like our big rocks, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess so. Yeah. I wonder how that would look if you're from another planet and you landed here and you're like, oh, look at this rock. We love it. It's worth more than other rocks. And they'd be like, cool.
No. The aliens would be like, ooh, they like gems too. Let's kill them all and take the gems. Yeah. But among the collection was the most iconic gems in here in the collection were, was of course, the Star of India, which was at that time the world's biggest sapphire. It weighed 563 carats.
That is nothing to sneeze at.
No, it's not. About the size of an egg. And then, but also there was the DeLong Star Ruby, which was 100 carats, also quite big.
That's big.
And it was actually considered the most perfect star ruby in the world. And also the Midnight Star, which is the largest black sapphire at 116 carats. And the reason they were called stars is because they all have this mineral impurity, which causes them to glow like a star, or really more like an asterisk, when a light is shined on them. And if you do an internet search on, say, the Star of India, you'll see what I'm talking about. It's really cool.
Yeah, I've seen it. It almost looks like a photo filter.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Anyway, that said, so yeah, those three big stars were kind of the centerpiece of the gem and mineral collection.
Now, this one's really going to blow your mind. This collection, which is worth an unimaginable amount of money.
And by the way, probably the most amazing collection of gems on the planet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This wonderful collection was not insured.
No.
And that's because the premiums would have been prohibitive. And the museum had, I guess, better things to spend its money on. So they relied on a massive security system to protect the gems from theft. How this security system was defeated will be the subject of this very podcast.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about our perps for a second. There were three ne'er-do-wells from Florida.
That's redundant.
Good point. Yeah, so first of all, Jack Roland Murphy also went by the name Murph the Surf. I think he was Murph the Surf because he was a surfer, among other things. So yeah, he was a college dropout from Pennsylvania who moved to Florida to take up surfing. He made a living teaching tennis, swimming, and scuba diving at expensive Miami Beach hotels. He was actually a highly intelligent, very athletic guy, and very, you know,
yeah, sounds like
a very adaptable person. He actually played classical violin, and he was excellent at it. And he played college level tennis, and he was just, you know, he was good at, when he took up surfing, you know, he was a neophyte, but he eventually became a champion surfer. He just was one of those people who is good at whatever he decides to do.
Yeah.
But he also, besides teaching these things at the hotels, he supplemented his income by climbing the walls of Miami high rises at night and sneaking in through open windows and leaving with stolen jewelry and artwork and other things. And also he had some fellow perps, and they would take boats to the inside of Miami Beach on the harbor there. There's got a lot of mansions there with waterfront docks and everything like that. So they would just cruise right up to those things and break into the mansions and tans, just steal all kinds of stuff and leave by boat.
Yeah,
so
that's pretty cool, man. That's some Mission Impossible stuff. I love it.
Yeah.
So one of his accomplices
on the boating missions.
On all of his missions was a man named Alan Dale Kuhn, and another one was Roger Frederick Clark. Less is known about these two because Murph the Surf was the flashiest and most charismatic character of the three, and so he attracted most of the attention from the press.
Yeah, he did. He was a fairly good looking guy, and he always wore expensive, nice suits and stuff, and always had some smart ass comment for the press or another, you know. And so the press loved him, and so yeah, he got a lot of coverage.
So our three perps were doing just fine in Miami, but eventually they started talking about making a real big score. Supposedly Murph the Surf had been inspired by the Hitchcock classic To Catch a Thief, which is an amazing film and a lot of fun. Yeah. And he wanted to be a high class thief, just like Cary Grant in that movie.
Yeah, it's not a bad role model to aspire to, I guess.
No.
So what they did is Murphy, Kuhn, and Clark drove up to New York in early October 64 in a Cadillac. Nice. They rented a suite of rooms on the 18th floor at the Cambridge House Hotel on West 86th Street in Manhattan. They spent their days doing recons of various gem collections and other stealable stuff in Manhattan. And they spent their nights partying in their hotel room. This turned out later, was a bad idea on their part. They should have kept a lower profile. Because one person who attended one of their parties turned out to be an NYPD informant.
Now, is that just bad luck, or was the NYPD sending him to these parties?
I don't know. I suspect it was just bad luck.
Yeah.
I think it was just one of these. It was a kind of a random thing. And then this informant just mentioned to his controller, or whatever you want to call him, is this detective handler at the NYPD, was named James Walsh. And he just mentioned that, hey, by the way, you might want to take a look at these three dudes. They're from Florida. They have apparently no visible means of support, no jobs that I know of, and yet they seem to have lots and lots of money. And they're just hanging out and partying in this suite of rooms at an expensive hotel in Manhattan. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Walsh, the detective, could not do anything at the time, really. And so, but he did remember them later on, which proved to be a bit of their undoing.
So Murphy, Kuhn, and Clark zeroed in on the J.P. Morgan Hall of Gems and Minerals because on their first visit, they noticed that security was actually pretty minimal.
Yeah,
there were security guards, but not that many of them. Mm. And they also noticed that they could move around the building exploring and looking for ways in and out without attracting much attention. Murphy was challenged once he was in a non-public area, and he just said that he was lost and looking for an exit, and that was that. They didn't worry about it. In their outside recons of the museum, they noticed that the Hall of Gems was in a wing that was adjacent to a courtyard, which was almost entirely enclosed on four sides. The way into the courtyard was blocked by an 8-foot fence, but for Murph, that was not really that big a deal.
Mm-hmm. And when they looked through the fence and into the courtyard, they saw that there was a fire escape going up the side of the building. So all they needed to do was get into the courtyard, climb up the fire escape, and get through a window. Of course, that's easier said than done, right? Because the windows were all sure to be closed and locked and wired with alarms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I guess not. The windows actually were closed and locked, but they were not on any alarm system, right? The management at the museum had gotten a little complacent about security. The gem collection was, as I said earlier, the most valuable one on the planet, I think. Mm-hmm. But it had been there for 70 years, and so far nobody had molested it.
Exactly.
So, you know, what the heck? Why worry? I mean, right?
Exactly. No, I mean, that's, you see that, you know, we've always done it this way, so why would we stop?
Yeah, that is, but yeah, that's just the most gobsmacking thing about this story.
It is pretty amazing that they just didn't have alarms. I mean, you know, New York in the 60s is not the same as New York in the 70s, but it wasn't like there weren't thieves, like people who would, you know, junkies who would smash in a window to see what they could grab. And, you know, if that goes for an apartment or a car, it would arguably go for a museum.
Yeah, no, actually, the 1960s in America, at least, was kind of the heyday of jewelry theft and gem theft. I mean, there was a lot of it going on. I mean, a hell of a lot of it going on. And so why these guys didn't take note of that and step up security is beyond comprehension.
Yeah, foolish. So Kuhn and Murphy spent quite a bit of time in the museum over the next few weeks. They varied it. One would go in the morning and the other in the afternoon after security guards had changed shifts. But they mix it up so no one would get too used to seeing their faces.
Exactly. Murphy goes in the morning one day and then he goes in the afternoon the next day. That kind of thing. Yeah.
Right. And they found what they were looking for. A window near the fire escape. It was in a fourth floor bathroom, which was not separated from the Hall of Gems by any security obstacles. According to one account, they did a dry run before the actual heist. They broke into the museum, hid in the Hall of Gems, and just watched to see how often the guard wandered by. This was like every half an hour. But there's some dispute about this. Alan Kuhn wrote a long article for Time magazine about the heist. And this is what he says happened. But
they did the dry run.
Yeah, exactly. And some people think he might have punched up the narrative just a bit because he was trying to shop the idea around Hollywood at the time.
Yeah.
And someone from Hollywood, it happens, also helped him write the article. So
Who was that?
That someone was Robert Conrad, the actor.
Oh, yeah.
He was in Wild West.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting. I didn't know he was a writer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how much actual writing he did, but he was certainly able to tell Kuhn the kinds of things studios look for in terms of plot elements, etc. And the dry run of the heist would add some dramatic tension and help you, you know, pad out your runtime.
Yeah, that makes
sense.
But
to me, that seems pretty risky. I mean, maybe you'll get away clean, but if someone notices evidence of a break-in the next day, then the whole plan is down the drain.
Exactly.
If they catch you, then the whole plan is down the drain and you didn't get away. You didn't even try to get away with anything.
Precisely, which is why I suspect it didn't really happen. And by the way, if you're wondering, the movie did get made. Murph the Surf, released in 1975. Subtitle was Live a Little, Steal a Lot.
Well, what does he do?
He's sort of a dealer in stones. Precious stones. Other people's stones.
You mean he's a jewel thief? Jack too?
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Whoa.
And it starred, guess who? Robert Conrad.
Conrad.
So
you made good.
I have not yet seen the movie, actually, so I can't comment as to its quality.
Honestly, for I heard about this episode, I'd never heard of it before.
Yeah,
me neither. I don't think it's regarded as a classic.
Yeah, no, it stars Robert Conrad and Don Stroud, so it's gonna have some really top drawer acting in it, I'm sure. So anyway, I don't know. Somebody out there, please watch this and then send us an email. Mm-hmm. Give us a review. We want to hear about it.
Definitely.
But back to reality, their plan was almost in place. They had a way in. They just needed to acquire a few certain high-tech items. They needed to get a rope, a glass cutter, and some duct tape. Luckily, they had some high power connections and they were able to procure these items.
yeah, I was going to say, it's not too hard to find. I think a decent hardware store would have all that stuff.
Yeah, no, this is usually the part of the heist movie where, you know, there's some they meet up with their special connection and Ian packs a special aluminum case and there's some really fancy piece of electronic gizmo in there that'll defeat the whole alarm system or, you know, something. I mean, yeah. And no. So this is that part of the movie. And, oh, what do you got here? Roll the duct tape. Okay.
That's all it takes. The day of the heist was October 29th, 1964. Late that afternoon, Jack Murphy visited the museum, and just before closing, he visited that fourth floor bathroom, and he unlatched the window.
Yeah.
High tech. This is remarkably similar to how my little thug friends and I used to break into a movie theater. Mm-hmm. One would buy a ticket, open the bathroom window, and we would climb up the basically the iron lattice on the side. Mm-hmm. Later that night, Kuhn and Murphy scaled the fence to the courtyard, just like I was talking about, while Clark waited outside, circling the block in a car with a walkie-talkie, watching for police. Kuhn and Murphy climbed up the fire escape to the fifth floor. They tied a rope to a column on the fifth floor, went back down the ladder, and used the rope to swing over to that unlatched bathroom window on the fourth floor. This is very cinematic.
Yeah.
Once inside, they stealthily made their way to the Hall of Gems.
So that's not that hard. I think, you know, actually, this is a heist that you and I could pull off, really.
Well, that's kind of why I brought up my movie going experience, because apparently a heist that a 12-year-old could have pulled off.
Yeah, really. Yeah, I'm not saying these guys were complete idiots or anything like that. There was a certain amount of planning, but still, it was remarkably easy for them to break into the museum.
Yeah.
So once inside the Hall of Gems, they used a glass cutter. They scribed circles above the gems and then put duct tape around the glass over onto it to keep it from shattering. Mm. And then wrapped on it smartly with a screwdriver handle till their little circle separated. Mm-hmm. And then they used suction cups to actually pull the piece out.
Mm. So this guy definitely saw it to catch a thief.
Yeah. And so, this has become kind of a staple in movies, actually, the whole suction cup and scribing.
That's what I was wondering.
Circle.
I think they were doing that in movies before 1964. So. Mm-hmm. Maybe not. Maybe this is where it all comes from.
Yeah, I believe in these guys actually in their planning stage, they actually did acquire some sheets of glass and practice their glass cutting technique.
That's smart because it's not as easy as you think.
No, I've always assumed that, you know, if I was the guy scribing that perfect circle, I would rap on it and the whole thing would just shatter and collapse, you know, and the security guard would.
Before you're tapping on it, you're just running the thing around it. I've had that happen when I was using glass cutters.
Uh-huh. Yeah. When the whole thing just like crazes.
Yeah. You start making your cut and the whole thing shatters.
Yeah. And then there's this horrendous sound and I feel a tap on my shoulder. And I know. That's why I never became an ace jewel thief myself.
Right. Right. It looks so easy in the movies.
Oh, it does. I know. But then they get to the Star of India, the centerpiece of the collection, and they knew that it had its own alarm system because they had chatted up the guards on some of their many visits.
Smart. And
again, great security here. You know, tell these guys all about your security systems. That's smart. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the plan was to try to disable the alarm. They looked in the cabinet underneath the display. And they saw, first of all, that the dedicated alarm system for the Star of India was battery powered, wasn't wired into the building's electricity at all. And the second thing they noticed is that the batteries for this alarm were corroded and dead. Yeah. So when they took the Star of India, the alarm didn't go off.
Whoa.
I know, right?
That's awesome.
There was some serious negligence here on the part of the museum. We've already said it. I'll say it again.
Yeah. My gosh.
Yeah.
So what did they steal? Well, they got the most priceless rocks of all time, of course, basically. The Star of India, the DeLong Star Ruby, and the Midnight Star. We talked about those. These were the Stars collection, which is an intended pun.
Yeah, they were the Stars, that's for sure.
Yeah, for sure. They also took the Eagle Diamond, which is a very large and very valuable rock, and a lot of smaller diamonds that were worth a whole pile of money. So way to keep your eyes on it, guys.
Yeah, no, Sam. Not every piece of this heist was recovered either. So some of those rocks are. By the way, they weren't just diamonds. I think there were some emeralds and other things out there that they stole as well.
Yeah.
But some seriously valuable rocks that they, you know, somebody now is wearing in a piece of jewelry, or they're in somebody's collection somewhere.
Yeah, check your wedding ring.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
We're down.
Looking at it right now. So our perps, having filled their pockets, left the building the way they came in. They caught separate cabs back to the hotel. And the next day, they flew back to Miami with the haul, which they hid underneath the boat. Nice. Roger Clark stayed on in New York for a few days.
Of course, there was plenty of consternation at the museum on the morning of the 30th.
Well, you betcha there was.
Naturally, the police were called. And the first thought was that it was an amateur job because the thieves had taken the highest profile gems, which would make them next to impossible to sell.
Oh, yeah.
But actually, our intrepid thieves had a plan for that, too. Alan Kuhn had an airline pilot friend who had connections overseas. The plan was to have him smuggle the rocks to the Far East and sell them to some rich foreign collector. So they were,
Well, that's a plan.
The museum's bookkeepers put the value of the gems at $410,000, which if you adjust that up for today is like $3.6 million.
Which is absurdly low, by the way.
Hey, man. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, even in 1964, I'm sure there were some rich collectors who would have been happy to pay $1 million for the Star of India alone.
Oh, hell yeah.
And then you get the whole set, right? The star set. Mm-hmm. You know, you get the Star of India, the DeLong Star Ruby, the Midnight Star. Yeah, I don't know. I have no idea. I think what do you think this would be worth, you know, in today's money, really?
It's really just worth whatever somebody is willing to pay for it. So who knows? I mean, for that set of rocks back in 64, 5 million, 10 million, 50 million, who the hell knows?
Yeah, it's hard to say.
I mean, yeah, if you put them at auction today and that set of rocks today.
Oh, man, it'd be staggering.
Oh, yeah. They would go for a staggering sum of money. But again, even though they're worth fabulous sums of money, it doesn't mean they're going to be easy to sell without getting busted.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. You know, and you have to have just the right connection, the right fence. Yeah.
Which these guys maybe didn't quite have. But but back to the police, they didn't have any leads. Mm-hmm. But the NYPD detective we mentioned earlier, James Walsh, he remembered what his informant had told him about the three questionable dudes with lots of cash staying at the Cambridge House Hotel. So he went by the hotel and talked to the desk clerk, who told him that Murphy and Kuhn had left suddenly the morning after the big heist. Suddenly, unexpectedly. So that was enough suspicious behavior to get a search warrant. And the cops went up to suite 1803 to search it. While they were doing that, Roger Clark, unfortunately for him, walked in on them and was immediately arrested. While they were searching the place, the police found a quantity of marijuana and also a gun, ammunition, and more incriminating floor plans to various New York museums.
Oh.
And also some books about gems.
Oops.
Yeah, they maybe should have burned that stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, pitched it.
Yeah. I mean, the pot and the gun, you know, that's okay. But I mean, the other stuff, no. And Clark was of course interrogated. He didn't hold out for long at all.
Yeah, I mean, could you picture the cops being like, "Oh, come on, he fessed up already. We were just getting started."
I know. Come on, dude. Let's have a little fun first.
We didn't even get the chance to beat it out of you.
I know.
I took this job.
I know. I just bought a new rubber hose, man. the poor cops. Yeah.
Clark told them about Kuhn and Murph the Surf, they're already back in Miami. The FBI arrested them and brought them back to New York. But the judge thought the case against them wasn't so strong, so he set a low bail, and they were back in Florida in a few days.
Well, so. Okay,
but in January 1965, they were back in New York for another hearing. The police had been scouring unsolved jury thefts, and they found a good one. See, a year before, Murph the Surf had robbed an actress, Ava Gabor.
Pistol whipped her.
And he pistol whipped her as well.
Yeah.
Jeez.
So then this other guy pointed this gun at me, and I, with my terrible temper, went after him. I swacked him, but I didn't hurt him. And then he hit me, this ungentlemanly bum.
Did you hit him? Did you bite him?
I didn't bite him. I couldn't have a chance to bite him. I just did like that. Then he hit me with the side of the gun here, and I got a nice shiner here.
So Ava Gabor, who was that? Tell us.
Oh, man. I mean, that's something. Yeah. So she's from back in the day. She used to be kind of a big deal, though. You know, like, so like this would have been like around the time that you were a kid. She was on, you know, Hollywood squares, but she was also in a really famous sitcom.
Well, I don't know. Green Acres, right?
Yeah, Green Acres. Green Acres is funny. The show's still funny.
Yeah, no, it was. Yeah, and I seem to recall seeing her on Hollywood Squares. Not that I watched that show that much, but it
sounds like something she'd be on.
Yeah. So
I think she was on that show.
Yeah, she was sister of Zsa Zsa Gabor, who I think was a little bit bigger in terms of stardom and stuff. Ava was a beautiful lady. And
she was, yeah.
Yeah.
And with that, I feel bad for her, honestly. I'm laughing, but I don't think she deserved to get a pistol whip. That sucks.
No, that does suck. So Jack Murphy was ID'd as the perp in that particular crime. So the police decided to charge Murphy, Kuhn, and Clark with that crime. And since the evidence was a lot stronger, there was a witness and a victim right there, Ava Gabor, the bail was raised to $100,000. So now our three perps were going to be stuck in jail because they didn't have $100,000 to post bail. So they decided to cooperate.
Oh, come on, guys.
Well, I know, right?
No, yeah. that's probably a good thing. Alan Kuhn said he could get the gems back if he got to go to Miami. He was sent with a police escort, and he spent a few days down there being shuttled between hotels and phoning as many of his underworld contacts as he could. I suspect this was a smokescreen because of all the people that he called, I'm guessing there was only one who actually knew where the rocks were.
Yeah, one or maybe two. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, he just didn't want to. You know, the police knowing who that person was. But eventually they had paid off. Eventually they got a phone call response from an anonymous person who gave them directions, which they followed to find a key. Uh-huh. And the key went to a locker at a Trailways bus terminal in Miami. And they sent a detective to go check it out. He found two small suede pouches and then were nine gems. The Star of India and the Midnight Star, along with five emeralds and two aquamarines. So
that's progress.
That's definitely progress. You know, not nearly the entire haul, but, you know, two of the most exotic rocks, the most expensive ones. But the DeLong Ruby and the Eagle Diamond were still missing, unfortunately.
Oh.
Yeah. And spoiler alert, by the way, the Eagle Diamond never was recovered.
The Eagle Diamond?
Yeah. Yeah. The Eagle Diamond, a huge diamond. Unique diamond. It's assumed it was probably cut up into smaller stones.
That makes sense.
Yeah, but I hope not, actually.
That'd be better if it was.
I mean, I'm secretly hoping that some rich dude has it in his secret collection as we speak, and maybe someday he'll die and it'll turn up again, you know, and who knows, but yeah.
So in April 1965, our three perps pleaded guilty to the museum heist, and they were sentenced to 3 years each at Rikers Island.
Oh, the famous so Rikers Island.
Yeah.
Here, that's a fun place.
Well, I don't think Rikers is any fun, but 3 years is not bad time for what they got caught with.
Yeah.
At least to me.
I think it probably did help that they were willing to at least try to get the loot back and give it back to the museum.
They cooperated.
Yeah.
In September, the DeLong Ruby was recovered. So that's good.
Yeah.
And as the story goes, rich guy John D. MacArthur somehow established communication with a Florida fence.
Yeah. He was, by the way, living in Florida at the time himself.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. That's interesting. That I'd love to know more about how this, you know, rich upper class guy managed to get in touch with a fence, or maybe the fence reached out to him.
I think it's more like that. I think it was just, or it might, he was known as a philanthropist, and it might just have been that, you know, the fence is puts it out to the police or whoever, that they have the ruby and they're willing to give it back for a ransom of $25,000 or more. Mm-hmm. And they just went around asking various rich people if they'd put up the money, and finally, and MacArthur was the guy who was willing to do that.
Yeah, that makes sense. That plays.
Yeah.
So MacArthur agreed to pay a ransom of $25,000. And after payment, he was directed to a phone booth by the Sunshine State Parkway near Palm Beach, Florida. The DeLong Star was stashed in a hole in the ceiling of the booth. And MacArthur sent a picture of the ruby to the museum, along with a note that said, "Neener, neener, neener, now I got your..."
I know, right? I like this. Screw you people. No, that's not right. And so ends the tale of the Star of India heist.
Yeah.
You two have suddenly achieved a certain amount of notoriety. Do you not enjoy the publicity?
Not by choice. We didn't gain this minor fame. This is something that I'd love to have done without. I'd love to have done without this. Like I keep telling my friends, how do I explain this to my family and my friends all over the country? And the same with Jack and Roger. We didn't care for all this.
Has the recent publicity about the museum jewel robbery markedly changed your way of living?
We find people in the restaurants, they notice you, on the street, they notice you at parties. And it's become a very embarrassing thing with our parents and with close friends. It is very embarrassing to be accused of something like this. And meanwhile, in New York, the jewel robberies continue to go on and on, and they're all down here trying to get something on us. We think it's a shame that they don't concentrate their efforts up there in the city where this happened. Maybe they could catch the people who did this.
Mr. Clark, these are serious charges which have been lodged against you. Are you very worried about the outcome?
Well, it is very serious, but we aren't guilty, so I really don't feel in this land, with the courts we have here, that we have anything to worry about.
This has got to be about the most low-tech jewel heist of all time.
Yeah.
When you consider how fantastic the take was.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
They just used rope and duct tape.
I mean, they were clever. I mean, to be sure, let's give them credit here. But they weren't like the world class burglars that you would expect to see in a case.
Right?
Like this.
Yeah, they're not exactly the burrowing bandits or whatever.
No, they're not Cary Grant either.
Nope. Yep.
No, to catch a thief.
But I mean, I will say they did plan it out pretty meticulously. I think in a lot of ways, though, the museum kind of at a certain point, you know, like if I leave my door open all the time, just open to the street and someone steals my TV. Yeah, that guy's a thief and he deserves to go to prison for larceny. But I mean, I kind of got myself in that situation.
Kind of did, you know, and you got to give credit to our guys, you know, our perps, as they recognized a sweet, sweet opportunity and they took it.
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah. Anyway, but it all turned out mostly well. Most of the stuff came back. So there was a postscript to the story. Jack Murphy was convicted of murder. Murph the Surf, that is.
Murph the Surf, who'd he kill?
Yeah, the Whiskey Creek slayings.
Whoa.
He and another guy were part of a conspiracy with a couple of women from Los Angeles who stole about $500,000 in negotiable securities from their employer somehow. I'm not up on every detail of it, but they were out on a boat. Apparently, Murph the Surf invited them to come out with his friend and accomplice onto the boat to talk about what they were going to do with the haul and how they were going to divvy it up, et cetera. And then, if somebody invites you out on a boat to talk about that kind of thing,
yeah,
don't go. I mean, oh my God. Murphy and his accomplice, the guy, they bludgeoned these two and bludgeoned and stabbed them to death. But, you know, they were not that competent in getting rid of the bodies because they tied concrete blocks to them and dumped them in this place called Whiskey Creek, which was sort of a creek, sort of an inlet, subject to tidal influence, of course. And when the tides were out, a fisherman noticed like a human foot sticking out of the water.
Oops.
So they were busted for that. And
I've heard like so many stories where like they could have got away with it if they would have just gotten a tide chart.
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
Like what's his name? Robert Durst.
Yeah.
Did that. He threw a bunch of hacked up limbs and stuff into Galveston Bay and the tide just brought it right back.
Yeah. You know, it's like, guys, I mean, this stuff is not rocket science. And water is, especially along coasts and everything, it's not static, you know, it's moving and it's going up and down and doing all kinds of stuff. But the other mistake they made was using concrete blocks.
Yeah,
as I said before, concrete is not nearly it's not nearly as heavy underwater as you think it is. It's
right.
It's way too buoyant. You want to use, you know, iron, steel, lead, something like that to get rid of your bodies. Don't use concrete blocks.
There you go.
Bad idea. And what other postscripts do we have here? Let's see.
Well, okay. So Murph the Surf, he was sentenced to 2 life terms, but he only served like 17 years. He got out in 1986.
Yeah. He did. He found Jesus in prison and turned his life around, or at least made a credible simulation thereof. enough to fool the parole board.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good for him.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned earlier, he died just this past September.
He did. You got some fairly long obits and everything, because he was way back in the day kind of a famous character, even if most of you guys haven't heard of him today.
Yeah, I admit I hadn't really heard of him, though I did hear about the theft of the Star of India, so I kind of knew his work.
Yeah.
What happened to John D. MacArthur?
John D. MacArthur eventually pawned the DeLong Star Ruby and used the proceeds to start a foundation. Well, maybe not.
Okay.
I do love the...
You had me kind of excited for a second that was like where the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation comes from.
Yeah, no, he gave the ruby back to the museum. But I still kind of like the idea that he got it back and just decided, hey, screw you guys.
Yeah.
And he would have been justified. I mean, he spent $25,000 of his own hard earned cash, number one.
That's true.
And number two, the museum, they were idiots. You know, it's like, right? I'm not going to give this thing back to you guys. You're incompetent. Screw you. But no, he did give it back to them. And hopefully they've upped their security since then.
I think so. You know. I've been there. In fact, regrettably, I don't have a clear memory of it, but I've almost certainly seen these things because the stars are back on display at the museum.
Yeah, they are.
So I mean, I believe you can go see them today, at least like, you know, 20 something years ago, you could see them. Pretty sure. And according to the museum curator, they're some of the most popular pieces in the entire gem collection.
Yeah.
But it is important to remember the Eagle Diamond and plenty, if not most, of the lesser stones, they just were never recovered.
Yeah, they weren't, unfortunately. So keep your eyes peeled for that there Eagle Diamond. Okay. We'll be posting a picture of it. So you can, you know what it looks like.
But, we'll put it up on our social media so you can be on the lookout for the Eagle Diamond. Yeah, is it shaped like an eagle?
A little bow.
I didn't Google
no,
it.
No, it's not. I'm not sure exactly how it came to be called the Eagle Diamond. But, you know, it's a cool name, and we like big diamonds, so yeah.
We do. We like those.
Yeah.
Well, that's a cool story.
It is.
It's too bad Murph the Surf died. We couldn't get him on the podcast.
That would have been kind of fun, yeah. I think he was more than happy to talk about his life of crime.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm sure he would have been cooperative, probably. But unfortunately, we were a little slow, and he went ahead. He just went on and died. So,
That's too bad. Well, I always love a good high story, and that's actually one I didn't know that much about.
Yeah, it's it's a remarkable contrast between the fabulousness of this take and the general, you know, mundaneness of the criminals who pulled it off. It's remarkable in that sense. But anyway, that's about it. You know, that's about it for this week, I think. Next week, we'll be back with not another heist, probably a murder or something fun like that.
We'll do something crazy. I'm working on a couple of leads.
Okay. Yeah, me too. But that's it this week. It looks like this turned out to be a bit of a short episode. So sorry about that, folks.
It was concise, not short, concise.
Yeah, exactly. We don't want to waste your time by padding out our episodes, for Christ's sakes. You know, we're not going to do that. We have principles, damn it.
Yes, we do,
damn it. So it's just time for the usual stuff, like, you know, leave us a rating and a review, and because we love that stuff, and it's very helpful to us. And
it really is. It's really helpful for people to be able to find the podcast. So share it around, tell a friend.
Absolutely.
It'd mean the world to us if you haven't written us a review, if you could please do that.
Absolutely. Please do. And a good review, by the way. Yeah, those are the kinds we really like. Let's see what else. Oh yeah, by the way, stay tuned for the lovely Tess reading off valuable information about our email address and our social media accounts and such.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it, I think. Until next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
The shocking details can be found at www.theshockingdetails.com. We're on Twitter @shockingdetails. For discussion of episodes and more, our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/shockingdetailspodcast/. Or you can email us at theshockingdetailspodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider giving us a like and a positive review and letting people know about us.